Macmillan Audio presents Killing Jesus, A History by Bill O'Reilly and Martin Dugar. This is Bill O'Reilly. This book is dedicated to those who love their neighbors as themselves. A note to listeners. In the beginning, to say that Jesus of Nazareth was the most influential man who ever lived is almost trite. Nearly 2,000 years after he was brutally murdered by Roman soldiers, more than 2.2 billion human beings attempt to follow his teachings and believe he is God. That includes 77% of the U.S. population, according to a Gallup poll. The teachings of Jesus have shaped the entire world and continue to do so. Much has been written about Jesus, the son of a humble carpenter, but little is actually known about him. Of course, we have the Gospels of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, but they sometimes appear contradictory and were written from a spiritual point of view rather than as a historical chronicling of Jesus' life. Who Jesus actually was and what exactly happened to him are emotional subjects that often lead to contentious discussion. In the writing of this fact-based book, Martin Dugard and I do not aim to suggest that we know everything about Jesus, but we do know much and will tell you things that you might not have heard. Our research has uncovered a narrative that is both fascinating and frustrating at the same time. There are major gaps in the life of Jesus, and at times we can only deduce what happened to him based upon best available evidence. Our sources are cited in the last pages of the book, along with some dissenting views where we feel another side of the story should be heard. As we did in our previous books, Killing Lincoln and Killing Kennedy, we'll tell you when we don't know what happened, or if we believe the evidence we are citing is not set in stone. The Romans kept incredible records of the time, and a few Jewish historians in Palestine also wrote down the events of the day. The problem is that it wasn't until the last few months of Jesus' short life that he became the focus of establishment attention. Until then, he was just another Jewish man struggling to survive in a harsh society. Only his friends paid much heed to what Jesus was doing. But those friends did pass much along verbally. And so we have the narrative of the Gospels. But this is not a religious book. We do not address Jesus as the Messiah, only as a man who galvanized a remote area of the Roman Empire and made very powerful enemies while preaching a philosophy of peace and love. In fact, the hatred toward Jesus and what happened because of it may at times overwhelm the listener. This is a violent story centered both in Judea and in Rome itself, where the emperors were also considered gods by their loyal followers. Martin Dugard and I are both Roman Catholics who were educated in religious schools, but we're also historical investigators and are interested primarily in telling the truth about important people, not converting anyone to a spiritual cause. We brought this dedication and discipline to Abraham Lincoln and John F. Kennedy, and in these pages we'll do the same with Jesus of Nazareth. By the way, both Lincoln and Kennedy believed Jesus was God. To understand what Jesus accomplished and how he paid with his life, we have to understand what was happening around him. His was a time when Rome dominated the Western world and brooked no dissent. Human life was worth little. Life expectancy was less than 40 years, and far less if you happened to anger the Roman powers that were. An excellent description of the time was written, perhaps with some bombast, by journalist Vermont Royster in 1949. Quote, "There was oppression for those who were not friends of Tiberius Caesar. What was man for but to serve Caesar? There was persecution of men who dared think differently, who heard strange voices or read strange manuscripts. There was enslavement of men whose tribes came not from Rome, disdain for those who did not have the familiar visage. And most of all, there was contempt for human life. What to the strong was one man more or less in a crowded world?" Then all of a sudden, there was a light in the world, and a man from Galilee saying, "Render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and unto God the things that are God's." And the voice from Galilee, which would defy Caesar, offered a new kingdom in which each man could walk upright and bow to none but his God. So the light came into the world, and the men who lived in darkness were afraid, and they tried to lower a curtain so that man would still believe that salvation lay with the leaders. But it came to pass for a while in diverse places that the truth did set men free, although the men of darkness were offended, and they tried to put out the light. Unquote. And these men succeeded, at least in the short term. Jesus was executed. But the incredible story behind the lethal struggle between good and evil has not been fully told until now. At least that is the goal of this book. Thank you for listening. Book 1, The World of Jesus. Chapter 1, Bethlehem, Judea, March 5 BC, morning. The child with 36 years to live is being hunted. Heavily armed soldiers from the capital city of Jerusalem are marching to this small town, intent on finding and killing the baby boy. They are a mixed-race group of foreign mercenaries from Greece, Gaul, and Syria. The child's name, unknown to them, is Jesus, and his only crime is that some believe he will be the next king of the Jewish people. The current monarch, a dying half-Jewish, half-Arab despot named Herod, is so intent on ensuring the baby's death that his army has been ordered to murder every male child under the age of 2 years in Bethlehem. None of the soldiers knows what the child's mother and father look like, or the precise location of his home. Thus, they need to kill every baby boy in the small town and surrounding area. This alone will guarantee the extermination of the potential king. It is springtime in Judea, the peak of the lambing season. The rolling dirt road takes the army past thick groves of olive trees and shepherds tending their flocks. The soldiers' feet are clad in sandals, their legs are bare, and they wear the skirt-like terugis to cover their loins. The young men sweat freely beneath the plates of armor on their chests and the tin bronze Attic helmets that cover the top of their heads and the side of their faces. The soldiers are well aware of Herod's notorious cruelty and his penchant for killing anyone who would try to threaten his throne. But there is no moral debate about the right and wrong of slaughtering infants, nor do the soldiers question whether they will have the nerve to rip a screaming child from his mother's arms and carry out the execution. When the time comes, they will follow orders and do their jobs, or risk being immediately killed for insubordination. The sword's blade is how they plan to dispatch the babies. Each soldier is armed with the Judean version of the razor-sharp pugio and gladius preferred by the Roman legions, and wear their weapons attached to the waist. Their method of murder, however, will not be restricted to the dagger or sword. Should they wish, Herod's soldiers can also use a skull-crushing stone, hurl a baby boy's off a cliff en masse, or just wrap their fists around the infant's windpipes and strangle them. The cause of death is not important. What matters most is one simple fact. King of the Jews or not, the infant must die. Meanwhile, in Jerusalem, King Herod gazes out a palace window toward Bethlehem, anxiously awaiting confirmation of the slaughter. In the cobbled streets below him, the Roman-appointed king sees the crowded bazaars where vendors sell everything from water and dates to tourist trinkets and roast lamb. The walled city of 80,000 residents, packed into less than a single square mile, is a crossroads of the eastern Mediterranean. With one sweep of his eyes, Herod can see visiting Galilean peasants, brightly dressed Syrian women, and the foreign soldiers he pays to wage his battles. These men fight extremely well, but are not Jews, and don't speak a word of the Hebrew language. Herod sighs. Back in his youth, he would never have stood in a window and worried about the future. A great king and warrior such as he would have ordered that a bridle be thrown over his favorite white charger so that he might gallop to Bethlehem and murder the child himself. But Herod is now a man of 69. His massive girth and incessant medical problems make it physically impossible for him to leave his palace, let alone mount a horse. His bloated face is wreathed in a beard that extends from the bottom of his chin to just below his Adam's apple. On this day, he wears a royal purple Roman-style mantle over a short-sleeve white silk tunic. Normally, Herod prefers soft leather leggings that have been stained purple. But today, even the gentlest bristle of fabric against his inflamed big toe is enough to make him cry out in pain. So it is that Herod, the most powerful man in Judea, hobbles through the palace barefoot. But gout is the least of Herod's ailments. The king of the Jews, as this non-practicing convert to the religion likes to be known, is also suffering from lung disease, kidney problems, worms, a heart condition, sexually transmitted diseases, and a horrible version of gangrene that has caused his genitals to rot, turn black, and become infested with maggots, thus the inability to sit astride, let alone ride, a horse. Herod has learned how to live with his aches and pains, but these warnings about a new king in Bethlehem are scaring him. Since the Romans first installed him as the ruler of Judea, more than 30 years ago, Herod has foiled countless plots and waged many wars to remain king. He has murdered anyone who would try to steal his throne and even executed those only suspected of plotting against him. His power over the locals is absolute. No one in Judea is safe from Herod's executions. He has ordered deaths by hanging, stoning, strangulation, fire, the sword, live animals, serpents, beating, and a type of public suicide in which victims are forced to hurl themselves off tall buildings. The lone form of execution in which he has not engaged is crucifixion, that most slow and humiliating of deaths, where a man is flogged and then nailed naked onto a wooden cross in plain sight of the city walls. The Romans are the masters of this brutal art, and they exclusively practice it. Herod would not dream of enraging his superiors in Rome by appropriating their favorite form of murder. Herod has 10 wives, or had, before he executed the fiery Miriam for allegedly plotting against him. For good measure, he also ordered the deaths of her mother and of his sons, Alexander and Aristobulus. Within a year, he will murder a third male offspring. Small wonder that the great Roman Emperor Caesar Augustus was rumored to have openly commented, "It is better to be Herod's pig than to be his son." But this newest threat, though it comes from a mere infant, is the most dangerous of all. For centuries, Jewish prophets have predicted the coming of a new king to rule their people. They have prophesied 5 specific occurrences that will take place to confirm the new Messiah's birth. The first is that a great star will rise in the east. The second is that the baby will be born in Bethlehem, the small town where the great King David was born 1,000 years before. The third prophecy is that the child must also be a direct descendant of David, a fact that can be easily proven by the temple's meticulous genealogical records. Fourth, powerful men will travel from afar to worship him. Finally, the child's mother must be a virgin. What troubles Herod most deeply is that he knows the first of the two to be true. He might even be more distressed to learn that all 5 have come to pass. The child is from the line of David. Powerful men have traveled from afar to worship him. And his teenage mother Mary swears that she is still a virgin despite her pregnancy. He also does not know that the child's name is Yeshua ben Joseph, or Jesus, meaning the Lord is salvation. Herod first learns about Jesus from the travelers who have come to worship the baby. These men are called Magi, and they stop at his castle to pay their respects en route to paying homage to Jesus. They are astronomers, diviners, and wise men who also study the world's great religious texts. Among these books is the Tanakh, a collection of history, prophecy, poetry, and songs telling the story of the Jewish people. The wealthy foreigners traveled almost 1,000 miles over rugged desert, following an extraordinarily bright star that shines in the sky each morning before dawn. "Where is the one who has been born the King of the Jews?" they demand to know upon their arrival in Herod's court. "We see his star in the east and have come to worship him." A footnote. In 1991, the Quarterly Journal of the Royal Astronomical Society, Volume 32, pages 389 to 407, noted that Chinese astronomers had observed a long-tailed, slow-moving comet in their skies during March of 5 BC. This Susing, or star, hung in the Capricorn region for more than 70 days. This same comet would have been visible in the skies over Persia, home of the Magi, in the hours just before dawn. Due to the Earth's orbital motion, the comet's light would have been directly in front of the Magi during their journey. Hence, they would have truly followed the star. Amazingly, the Magi carry treasure chests filled with gold and the sweet-smelling tree resins, myrrh and frankincense. These priests are learned, studious men. Theirs is a life of analysis and reason. Herod can only conclude either that the Magi are out of their minds for risking the theft of such great fortune in their vast and lawless Parthian desert, or they truly believe this child to be the new king. A furious Herod summons his religious advisors. As a secular man, he knows little about Jewish prophecies. Herod insists that these high priests and teachers of religious law tell him exactly where to find the new king. The answer comes almost immediately, in Bethlehem, in Judea. The teachers whom Herod is interrogating are humble men. They wear simple white linen capes and robes. But the bearded temple priests are a far different story. They dress elaborately in white and blue linen caps with a gold band on the brow and blue robes adorned in bright tassels and bells. Over their robes, they wear capes and purses adorned in gold and precious stones. On a normal day, their garb distinguishes them from the people of Jerusalem. But even in his dissipated state, King Herod is the most regal man in the room by far. He continues to hector the teachers and priests. Where is this so-called king of the Jews? Bethlehem, in the land of Judah. They quote verbatim from the words of the prophet Micah, some 7 centuries earlier. Out of you will come a ruler who will be the shepherd of my people Israel. Herod sends the Magi on their way. His parting royal decree is that they locate the infant, then return to Jerusalem and tell Herod the child's precise location so that he can venture forth to worship the new king himself. The Magi see through this deceit. They never come back. So it is that time passes and Herod realizes he must take action. From the windows of his fortress palace, he can see all of Jerusalem. To his left rises the great temple, the most important and sacred building in all of Judea. Perched atop a massive stone platform that gives it the appearance of a citadel rather than a simple place of worship, the temple is the physical embodiment of the Jewish people and their ancient faith. The temple was first built by Solomon in the 10th century B.C. It was leveled by the Babylonians in 586 B.C. And then the second temple was built by Zerubbabel and others under the Persians nearly 70 years later. Herod recently renovated the entire complex and expanded the temple size to epic proportions, making it far larger than that of Solomon's. The temple and its courts are now a symbol, not just of Judaism, but of the evil king himself. So it is ironic, as Herod frets and gazes toward Bethlehem, that Jesus and his parents have already traveled to Jerusalem twice and paid visits to the great stone fortress built atop the site where the Jewish patriarch Abraham nearly sacrificed his own son, Isaac. The first visit came 8 days after Jesus was born, so that he might be circumcised. There, the child was formally named Jesus, in keeping with the prophecy. The second visit came when he was 40 days old. The baby Jesus was brought to the temple and formally presented to God in keeping with the laws of the Jewish faith. His father, Joseph, a carpenter, dutifully purchased a pair of young turtle doves to be sacrificed in honor of this momentous occasion. Something very strange and mystical occurred as Jesus and his parents entered the temple on that day, something that hinted that Jesus might truly be a very special child. Two complete strangers, an old man and an old woman, neither of whom knew anything about this baby called Jesus or his fulfillment of prophecy, saw him from across the crowded place of worship and went over to him. Mary, Joseph, and Jesus were traveling in complete anonymity, avoiding anything that would draw attention to them. The old man's name was Simeon, and he was of the belief that he would not die until he laid eyes upon the new king of the Jews. Upon seeing Jesus, Simeon asked if he might hold the newborn. Mary and Joseph agreed. As Simeon took Jesus into his arms, he offered a prayer to God, thanking him for the chance to see this new king with his own eyes. Then Simeon handed Jesus back to Mary with these simple words: "This child is destined to cause the falling and rising of many in Israel, and to be a sign that will be spoken against, so that the thoughts of many hearts will be revealed, and a sword will pierce your own soul too." At that very moment, a woman named Anna also approached. She was an 84-year-old widow prophetess who spent all her waking hours in the temple, fasting and praying. Simeon's words were still ringing in Mary and Joseph's ears when Anna stepped forth and also praised Jesus. She loudly thanked God for bringing this very special baby into the world. Then she made a most unusual claim, predicting to Mary and Joseph that their son would free Jerusalem from Roman rule. Mary and Joseph marveled at Simeon's and Anna's words, flattered for the attention as all new parents would be, but also unsure what all this talk about swords and redemption truly meant. They finished their business and departed from the temple into the bustling city of Jerusalem, both elated and fearful for the life their son might be destined to lead. If only Herod had known that Jesus had been so close, literally less than 600 yards from his throne room, his torment could have been relieved. But Jesus and his parents were just three more bodies making their way through the noisy bazaars and narrow, twisting streets en route to the temple that day. It is a temple that will stand forever as a monument to Herod's greatness, or so he believes. Ironically, he is barely welcome inside its walls thanks to his utter lack of devotion or faith and his ruthlessness in subjugating the Jewish people. Beyond the temple on the far side of the Kidron Valley rises the steep Mount of Olives, where shepherds tend their flocks on the grasses of the limestone-flecked hillsides. Soon will come the Passover feast, bringing with it tens of thousands of Hebrew pilgrims from all over Herod's kingdom, eager to pay good money to purchase those sheep for a sacrificial slaughter in the great temple. In many ways, the slaughter of the babies in Bethlehem is no different. They are being sacrificed for the good of Herod's rule, which is the same as saying they are being murdered in the name of the Roman Empire. Herod is nothing without Rome, a puppet who owes his kingdom completely to the brutal and all-powerful Republic. It is his right and duty to propagate its oppressive ways. For Herod's kingdom is different from any other under Rome's iron fist. The Jewish people are an ancient civilization founded upon a belief system that is at odds with Rome's, which worships many pagan deities instead of the one solitary Jewish god. Herod is the intermediary in this precarious relationship. The Romans will hold him accountable for any problems caused by an alleged new king of the Jews. They will not tolerate a ruler they have not themselves chosen. And if the followers of this new king foment revolution, it's certain that the Romans will immediately step in to brutally crush this voice of dissent. Better that Herod handle it himself. Herod cannot see Bethlehem from his palace, but it is roughly 6 miles away on the far side of some low green hills. He cannot see the blood flowing in its streets right now, nor hear the wails of the terrified children and their parents. As Herod gazes out from his palace, he does so with a clean conscience. Let others condemn him for murdering more than a dozen infants. He will sleep well tonight, knowing that the killings are for the good of his reign, the good of Judea, and the good of Rome. If Caesar Augustus hears of this slaughter, he will surely understand. Herod is doing what must be done. Jesus and his family barely get out of Bethlehem alive. Joseph awakes from a terrifying dream and has a vision of what is to come. He rouses Mary and Jesus in the dead of night, and they escape. Herod's soldiers arrive too late. They butcher the babies in vain, fulfilling a prophecy made 500 years ago by the contrarian prophet Jeremiah. There are many more prophecies about the life of Jesus outlined in Scripture. Slowly but surely, as the child grows to manhood, these predictions will also come true. Jesus' behavior will see him branded as a revolutionary known throughout Judea for his startling speeches and offbeat teachings. He will be adored by the Jewish people, but will become a threat to those who profit from the populace. The high priests, scribes, elders, the puppet rulers of Judea, and most of all, to the Roman Empire. And Rome does not tolerate a threat. Thanks to the examples of empires such as those of Macedonians, Greeks, and Persians that came before them, the Romans have learned and mastered the arts of torture and persecution. Revolutionaries and troublemakers are dealt with in a harsh and horrific fashion, in order that others will not be tempted to copy their ways. So it will be with Jesus. This too will fulfill prophecy. All that is to come. For now, Jesus is still an infant, cared for and loved by Mary and Joseph. He was born in a stable, visited by the Magi, presented with their lavish gifts, and is now on the run from Herod and the Roman Empire. Footnote. The most insightful facts, quotes, and stories about Jesus that we know come from the four Gospels of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Many today challenge these writings, but thanks to scholarship and archaeology, there is a growing acceptance of their overall authenticity. Many scholars believe that Matthew was written in Greek by the disciple and former tax collector sometime between AD 50 and 70. Mark was written by John Mark, a close friend of Peter's, who most likely learned of Jesus through the preaching of Peter. Matthew and Mark are incredibly similar, leading many to wonder if Matthew used Mark as a reference or vice versa. Luke was a friend of Paul, the former Pharisee who became a convert to Christianity and preached even more zealously than the disciples. The Gospel of Luke was written for a Gentile audience, with the theme of salvation at its center. John was written by the disciple, and its focus is evangelism. John's Gospel is written in Greek, and is long believed to have been the last Gospel written. The Gospels of Matthew, Mark, and Luke are known as the Synoptic Gospels due to the many ways in which they agree with one another. All four Gospels together are known as the Canonical Gospels, as they form the essential canon of the Christian faith. John wrote independently of the other gospel writers, using his unique eyewitness testimony in the same manner as Matthew. If he did indeed write his gospel last, then John would have had the final say on the life of Jesus, not just confirming what the others had written, but adding the definitive chronology and sequence of events. The fact that John was not only there at every pivotal moment of Jesus' ministry, and thus able to describe many scenes with vivid first-person imagery, but was also Jesus' closest confidant among the disciple whom Jesus loved, he boasts in John 22, and yet another example of the disciples grappling for prestige and power in the eyes of their leader. That only adds power to John's narrative. Chapter 2, Rome, March 15, 44 B.C., 11 a.m. The dictator with 1 hour to live rides atop the shoulders of slaves. Julius Caesar sits comfortably inside his litter, dressed in his usual dapper fashion, a loose belt, purple wool toga over a white silk tunic, and a wreath of oak leaves atop his head that attest to his heroism while also hiding the bald spot he so despises. Lately, Caesar has developed a passion for wearing high red boots, but on this morning his feet are clad in sandals. He is barely contemplating his upcoming meeting with the Roman Senate, for which he is already late. The thoughts most on his mind are rumors of a death, his own. But, of course, Caesar has no idea that the whispered gossip of his impending demise will prove all too true. Julius Caesar is the most powerful man in the world, so mighty that he has not only changed the number of days per year, but will soon have the month of his birth and the entire calendar renamed after himself. Today is the equivalent of Wednesday in the 7-day Jewish week, but the Romans use the 8-day cycle and give their days a letter rather than a name, so today is simply G. They also believe in giving each sunrise a number, so now it is the 15th day of Martius in the year 44 BC on Caesar's brand new Julian calendar, or as it is known, the Ides of March. And, as the great Roman orator and lawyer Cicero will soon write, the Ides changed everything. The 55-year-old Divus Julius, Julius the God, as the Roman Senate will later proclaim him, is being carried through Rome. The day is warm, but not hot, and the people stand back in awe as Caesar passes by. He is a man of average height, but extraordinary determination, having successfully conquered, invaded, or allied Rome with what will later be called Spain, Britain, France, Egypt, and Italy. Caesar is a study of conflict in his personal life, eating little and drinking even less, even as he spends money with abandon, such as when he commissioned the construction of a new villa, only to tear it down as soon as it was completed because he felt it wasn't perfect. And while many Roman men are wary of their sex drives, believing in the myth that too much sex will drain the virility from their bodies, Caesar has no such compunction. Calpurnia is his third wife, but he has had many mistresses, including the ambitious Cleopatra of Egypt. Now reclined in his litter, the well-muscled warrior statesman, contemplates the subject of murder, his own. Friends, soothsayers, and even his beloved Calpurnia, whom he first bedded when he was 40 and she was a 16-year-old virgin, have all warned him that something terrible will happen today. It was Calpurnia who made Caesar late this morning. Last night she dreamed, in a most vivid fashion, that he would be assassinated and begged him not to go to the Senate. Under normal circumstances, Caesar would have ignored her forebodings. But in the past few days, informants have urgently warned him about a conspiracy to kill him. Given the choice of heeding those warnings or ignoring them, Caesar has chosen to brush them off and even make light of them. "What is the sweetest way to die?" asked Lepidus, Caesar's second-in-command, two nights earlier over dinner. "The kind that comes without warning," the dictator shot back. Caesar indulged Calpurnia's fears for much of the morning. He even sent word that the Senate be dismissed. But then Decimus Brutus, the great general who had crushed the Venetian fleet during the Gallic Wars, arrived at Caesar's home and begged him to ignore Calpurnia's nightmares. He reminded Caesar of his impending journey to Parthia, the land west of Judea, where Rome's legions had suffered one of their most bruising defeats at the Battle of Carrhae nearly 10 years earlier. Caesar's aim is to subjugate the Parthians, who hail from the mountainous deserts of modern-day Iran and Iraq, and continue the expansion of Rome's global empire. The scheduled departure is March 18th, just 3 days away. Caesar could be gone for months, perhaps a year. So it's urgent that he meet with the Senate and clear up any unfinished business. Brutus also hints that there might be a nice surprise awaiting Caesar. A month ago, the 900 members of the Senate named Caesar dictator for life. Now Brutus is intimating that they might also name Caesar king this morning, meaning that he will become the first monarch Rome has known in almost 500 years. The citizens of Rome have enjoyed a democratic republic ever since a king was overthrown in 509 BC, and they are so averse to the idea of an absolute ruler that the Latin word for king, Rex, is considered repugnant. But as Caesar draws closer and closer to his meeting with the Senate, he is sure that the people feel differently about him. He has long been devoted to keeping the masses happy. One way to do this is by ensuring that popular entertainment is available to one and all, distracting them from any issues they might have about their government. Right now, for example, as Caesar's path to the Senate takes him from his home on the Via Sacra and out beyond the Pomerium, Rome's sacred boundary, he can hear the roar of the crowds in the theater of Pompey's Grand Arena as they gather to watch a blood-soaked gladiatorial battle. The Theater of Pompey was built by and named after Caesar's greatest rival. The 11-year-old column structure is made of stone and concrete, unlike the wooden theaters that have long been a staple of Roman life. It is an enormous and complex work of architecture, so monumental, in fact, that in the entire 700-year history of Rome, there has never been a larger or more elaborate entertainment venue. One half is comprised by the D-shaped amphitheater, where popular entertainment such as plays and gladiatorial competitions take place. Mock battles with elephants have been staged there, as well as real combat between lions and men. The garden area features lavish flower beds and arcades decorated with fountains and statuary, and partially covered to allow people to escape from the rain or sun. Still another portion of this theater is the cool and quiet marble floor Great Hall, where the Roman Senate meets. Caesar could have changed the facility's title after Pompey's execution, but demeaning his rival's memory would have served no useful political purpose. And so it is that Pompey's name still adorns this magnificent structure, and that a giant marble statue of the fallen general watches over the portico of the Great Hall as if listening in on everything the Senate has to say. The people of Rome joyfully mob Caesar's litter as the slaves carry him toward the Campus Martius, an open plain along the River Tiber, where Roman legions assemble before marching off to war. Once, to ensure his popularity with those armies, Caesar gave each soldier his own personal slave, taken from the ranks of the Gauls they had just defeated in battle. The legionnaires have never forgotten that gift and continue to reciprocate by showing Caesar their unconditional support. So, unlike many dictators, Caesar is quite sure of his personal safety. He's even reassigned the 2,000 soldiers who once served as his personal guards and is unafraid to walk freely through the streets of Rome, so that one and all can see that he is not a tyrant. I would rather die, Caesar has noted, than be feared. As the journey comes to an end at Pompey's theater, Caesar spies a familiar face in the crowd. The day which you warned me against is here, Caesar calls out to Spurinna, the fortune teller who was bold enough to predict that a terrible fate would befall the empire's leader on this very day. Spurinna divined this knowledge by studying the raw livers of sacrificed sheep and chickens. The goddess Venus Genetrix is Caesar's personal deity, and he has dedicated a large temple in her honor. But on this morning, Caesar has little use for religion or superstition. He wears a confident smile on his face, but is one that quickly vanishes when Spurinna offers his reply. Yes, he shouts over the clamor of the loyal people of Rome, who now press in around Caesar's litter. Spurinna is quite sure of his prediction, and not at all fearful of being reprimanded for what he is about to say. It is here, but it is not yet gone. Caesar hears these words, but does not respond. Gathering his purple toga to his body with his left arm, he steps from his litter, hoping to soon become the king of Rome. But there will be no coronation. Instead, a team of assassins waits for Caesar inside the Senate. These killers are not soldiers or angry citizens, but self-styled liberators comprised of a dozen of Caesar's closest friends and trusted allies, men of regal bearing and upbringing, whom he trusts completely and with whom he has shared many a meal and battlefield victory. These rogue senators are uneasy about Caesar's ever-growing power and his desire to be king. Such a promotion would not only ensure Caesar's authority for life, but also that it be passed down through his will to the heir of his choice. That Caesar publicly refused a crown when his good friend Mark Antony recently tried to place one around his head does not appease them. With these thoughts, along with nagging doubts that they might not have the guts to follow through on their assassination plan, the rebel senators have waited in their Senate seats all morning, freshly sharpened pugionas concealed between the thick folds of their togas. The liberators are in the minority, just 60 men among 900. And if they lose their nerve, there's every chance they will be in prison, executed, or exiled. Caesar is known to be a benevolent man, but he's also quick to exact revenge, such as the time he ordered the crucifixion of a band of pirates who had kidnapped him. Benevolent in that instance meant executioners dragging the razor-like steel of a pugio across each pirate's windpipe before nailing him to the cross, so that his death might be quicker. Some of the senators, such as the general and statesman Decimus Junius Brutus Albinus, have fought in war and are well acquainted with the act of killing. Brutus, as he is known, was the one sent to Caesar's home to lure him to the Senate when it appeared he might not show up this morning. It was Caesar who named Brutus to the position of praetor, or magistrate. But Brutus's family has a long tradition of rejecting tyrants, beginning with Junius Brutus in 509 B.C., the man credited with overthrowing the king and ending the Roman monarchy. That act of rebellion was as cold-blooded as the murder the liberators had planned for Julius Caesar. Other senators, such as the heavy-drinking Lucius Tilius Cimber and his ally Publius Servilius Cassa Longus, have the soft and uncalloused hands of elected officials. Wielding a killing blade will be a new sensation for them. Murdering Caesar is the boldest and most dangerous of ideas. He is not like other men. In fact, he has become the greatest living symbol of Roman power and aggression. Caesar has so completely consolidated his hold on Roman politics that the only likely outcome of this murder will be anarchy and perhaps even the end of the Roman Republic. This is hardly the first time someone has wanted Julius Caesar dead. The 1 million inhabitants of the city of Rome are reactive and unpredictable. Caesar is known by everyone and admired by most. Since the age of 15, when his father suddenly died while putting his shoes on one morning, Caesar has endured one challenge after another in order to make himself a success. But each contest has made him stronger, and with each hard-won triumph, his legend and his power has grown. But in terms of sheer glory, legend, and impact, no moment will ever match the morning of January 10th, 49 B.C. Caesar is a great general now, a 50-year-old man who has spent much of the last decade in Gaul, conquering the local tribes and getting very rich in the process. It is dusk. He stands on the north side of a swollen, half-frozen river known as the Rubicon. Behind him stand the 4,000 heavily armed soldiers of the Legio 13, Gemina, a battle-hardened group that has served under him for the last 9 years. Rome is 260 miles due south. The Rubicon is the dividing line between Cisalpine Gaul and Italy, or more germane to Caesar's current situation, between freedom and treason. The population of Gaul has been devastated by Caesar's wars. Of the 4 million people who inhabited the region stretching from the Alps to the Atlantic, 1 million have been killed in battle, and another million taken into slavery. After capturing a town along the Dordogne River near modern-day Varac, Caesar cut off the hands of every man who'd fought against him. And during his epic siege of Alesia, in the hills near what is now called Dijon, he surrounded the fortress with 60,000 men and 9 miles of fierce fortifications. All this could be viewed from above, from tall towers erected by Caesar's engineers, allowing the Roman archers to rain arrows down on the enemy forces. In order to break out of the besieged town, the trapped Gauls would have to find a way through this killing zone. When food began running out, the Gauls, under the legendary general Vercingetorix, allowed their women and children to exit the city so that the Romans might feed them. This was an act of dubious kindness, for it likely meant a life of slavery, but it was better than allowing them to starve to death inside the city. However, Caesar would not allow these innocents to cross over into the Roman lines. As their husbands and fathers looked on from within the city walls, unable to allow them back inside for lack of food, the women and children were forced to remain in the no man's land between armies, where they lived on grass and dew until they slowly perished from starvation and thirst. Adding insult, Caesar refused to allow their bodies to be collected for burial. But Caesar's greatest atrocity, and the one for which his enemies in the Roman Senate have now demanded that he stand trial as a war criminal, were committed against two Germanic tribes in 55 BC. These hostile invaders had slowly begun moving across the Rhine River into Gaul, and it was believed that they would soon turn their attention south toward Italy. From April to June of 55 BC, Caesar's army traveled from his winter base in Normandy to where marauding elements of the Germanic tribes were aligning themselves with Gauls against Rome. These tribes were not small nomadic communities, but an invading force with a population half the size of Rome's, numbering almost 500,000 soldiers, women, children, and camp followers. Hearing of Caesar's approach, the Germans sent forth ambassadors to broker a peace treaty. Caesar refused, telling them they had to turn around and go back across the Rhine. The Germans pretended to go along with Caesar's demands, but a few days later they reneged on their word and launched a surprise attack. As Caesar's cavalry watered their horses along what is now the Neres River, 800 German horsemen galloped directly toward them with intent to kill. The German tactics were peculiar and terrifying. Rather than wage battle atop their mounts, they leapt from their horses and used their short spears or battle swords to slit open the bellies of the Roman steeds. This not only killed the animals, but sent the now foot-bound legions fleeing in panic. Caesar considered the attack an act of duplicity, because it came during a time of truce. After having sued for peace by way of stratagem and treachery, he would later write, they had made war without provocation. In a dramatic show of force, Caesar launched a counterattack of his own. Placing his disgraced cavalry at the rear of his force, he ordered the legions to trot double time the 8 miles to the German camp. This time, it was the Romans who had the element of surprise. Those Germans who stood their ground were slaughtered, while those who tried to run were hunted down by the disgraced Roman cavalry, who were bent on proving their worth once more. Some Germans made it as far as the Rhine, but then drowned while trying to swim the hundreds of yards to the other side. But Caesar didn't stop there. His men rounded up all remaining members of the German tribes and butchered them, old men and women, wives, teenagers, children, and toddlers, yielding a killing ratio of 8 Germans for each legionnaire. Generally, the Roman soldiers are educated men. They can recite poetry and enjoy a good witticism. Many have wives and children of their own, and could never imagine such barbarous cruelty being visited on those they love. But they are legionnaires trained and disciplined to do as they are told. So they use the steel of their blades and the sharpened tips of their spears to pierce body after body after body, ignoring the screams of terrified children and the wails and pleas for mercy. Caesar's revenge began as an act of war, but soon turned into a genocide that killed an estimated 430,000 human beings. And just to show the Germans living on the other side of the Rhine that his armies could go anywhere and do anything, Caesar ordered his engineers to build a bridge across that previously impregnable river. This they accomplished in just 10 short days. Caesar then crossed the Rhine and launched a brief series of attacks, then withdrew and destroyed the bridge. Rome is a vicious republic and gives no quarter to its enemies. But these brutal offenses were too much, even for the heartless Roman leadership in the Senate, who called for Caesar's arrest. Cato, a statesman renowned for not just his oratory, but also for his long-running feud with Caesar, suggested the general be executed and his head given on a spike to the defeated Germans. The charges against Caesar were certainly not without merit, but they stemmed as much from political rivalry as from the slaughter on the banks of the Rhine. One thing, however, is clear. Caesar's enemies wanted him dead.